Now I'm just going to introduce our four panelists. To my left, Professor Andrew Bacevich of Boston University, Professor Tom Bender of New York University, Professor Renata, pardon me, Ellen Schrecker. I was doing it the order on the poster. Professor Ellen Schrecker of Yeshiva University, and finally, Professor Renata Breidenthal, emerita at Brooklyn College in CUNY. Having said that, I'm going to ask each of them to make a short statement, just to give some idea of where they're coming from, and then we'll dive into some of the questions that we've come up with and see where it goes. So, Andrew.
First of all, thanks for the invitation. A great honor for me to appear with such distinguished colleagues. My beat is contemporary U.S. foreign policy, so I'll try to devote my 2 minutes to that. Certainly, I view the war in Iraq, as unnecessary, misguided, and counterproductive. And my view of Bush foreign policy, I confess to having voted for Bush, as just perversely incompetent. Having said that, the thing I want to emphasize is the imperative, I think, of distinguishing between what seems to be new and seems to be a departure and what actually is. My general view is that in our preoccupation with what appears to be novel in Bush foreign policy, we really miss important things that are carrying over from prior administrations. That is that significant continuities continue to inform U.S. foreign policy. And if we really want to understand what makes the United States tick as a superpower, we need to attend to those continuities. To put it another way, while it's certainly true, at least it's true in my judgment, that the Bush administration has embarked upon a radical course when it comes to tactics, the naked embrace of preventive war, the disregard for operating in a multilateral framework, tactics, radically different, that strategically, the Bush administration really is acting in ways that are consistent with U.S. behavior going at least back to 1940, if not to 1898. That is to say that the Bush administration falls within the pre-existing strategic consensus in several ways. And I'll conclude just by ticking off what I think those several ways are. First, in Bush's conviction, his administration's conviction, that history has a discernible direction and a discernible outcome, and that outcome is defined by the universal embrace of American values. Second, in Bush's belief, his administration's belief, that the United States is called upon to remain, is destined to remain, must remain, the world's only superpower, the supreme nation state of the international order. Third, in Bush's belief, his administration's belief, that American prosperity, American security, and American freedom is dependent upon U.S. dominance of strategically significant regions of the world, and that the ultimate expression of dominance is to bring those regions into alignment with U.S. values. And finally, in Bush's belief, his administration's belief, that the United States must maintain global military supremacy, and that armed force has become the most efficacious instrument of U.S. foreign policy. I think in many respects that's the essence of the Bush strategy, but it does not differ in any significant way from the strategy of, for example, the Clinton administration, in my judgment, and it very much defines the views that are embraced by elites in both of the major political parties. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, I'm not a specialist in the recent period. I'm really more or less an 18th and 19th century historian. And I want to say some of the same things, actually, from a longer yet perspective. I think that one can argue that from the time of our first foreign war, that is Thomas Jefferson's war with the Barbary pirates in the Eastern Mediterranean, the guiding principle of American foreign policy has been that we have a right of access to global trade. Trade has taken different forms from ocean commerce to finance in the 20th century, but I think that is assumed as a right. There's another thing that is behind that, and that is there is an assumption that the world itself, the globe itself, has a natural right to development. And those who know best how to develop it ought to do the developing and guide those others. So I think that's a framework that has been around. It's a very general framework, but it's been around a long, long time, as long as the United States have operated under the present Constitution. I think within that, that Bush has committed himself to a radical set of both domestic and foreign policies. Perhaps the most radical, at least in style, which I would almost characterize as Jacobin. But in purpose, as Europeans seem to recognize, it is seems to be intended to disrupt all settled ways of doing things in almost every domain, not necessarily changing the end, but certainly the procedures or tactics, whatever you want to call it. I don't think that any other leader of the United States has undertaken at once so many radical policies at home and abroad, many of which are fundamentally at odds with what I'll call, and I emphasize this, the best traditions of American history. The problem is there are other traditions besides the best ones. And I think we sometimes make a mistake of thinking that there is a kind of progress beyond them. We've gotten beyond these sort of darker sides of American history. I don't think we have. And specific ones that bear on this are the Mexican War, a war of choice, argued on false claims of attacking American soldiers on American ground, as Lincoln pointed out. And it was, in a sense, lying to begin a war of conquest. Remember the Maine, a refusal to negotiate, and a refusal to inquire deeply into what really happened in Havana Harbor. The Philippine colonization process, the colonial administration, was a huge miscalculation, to use Bush's latest word. The concentration camps, the prisoner scandals there, this happened before the Japanese internment, the Red Scare, McCarthyism. These values are not only in our past. These are continuing values. And I think what it means that American historians really have to think differently about American history. It is not a linear thing in which things get taken care of. It seems to me these things are parts of the American past that are also valued by parts of the American population in different ways. And I think one has to keep redefining some of the issues that are continually contested. And to go back to one of the contests, I just want to read a quote from Abraham Lincoln that is so absolutely appropriate to this moment that it's not too long. He's talking about those people who want to expand freedom in the 1840s, that is the Manifest Destiny folks. And he says that the proponent of expansion is a great friend of humanity, and his desire for land is not selfish, but merely an impulse to extend the area of freedom. He is very anxious to fight for the liberation of enslaved nations and colonies, provided always that they have land, I would say oil today, and they have not liking for his interference. As to those who have no land, and he was referring to the slaves in the U.S. South, I would say the inner city poor and rural poor today, and those who have no land and would be glad for help from any quarter, he considers that they can afford to wait a few hundred years longer. Thanks.
Ellen?
Sure. As some of you may know, I've written several books about McCarthyism. And so today, I guess I'm looking at the Bush administration's record with regard to civil liberties and freedom of speech here at home. And I think we're working toward a consensus, at least up here, about the fact that the administration has not completely broken with some rather unfortunate American traditions. Certainly when we look at the administration's civil liberties record from a partisan perspective, and after all, there is a Republican convention about to begin, it's helpful to remember that Joseph McCarthy was a very partisan Republican. At the same time, of course, A. Mitchell Palmer, the man who instigated the infamous Palmer raids during the Red Scare right after World War I, was a Democrat and actually expected to become president on the basis of his record in clamping down on radical agitators in the aftermath of World War I, i.e. the war on terrorism. It didn't work then. And we should also remember that J. Edgar Hoover, who we can identify as the most single repressive individual, certainly in the 20th century, was essentially nonpartisan. He supported whatever politician supported him. So what we've seen in the American past is that political repression is something that is as American as apple pie, and that the abuse of individual rights and political freedom goes back certainly to the trial of Anne Hutchinson in the 17th century and continues through to the present moment. In particular, time and again, we've seen the government taking advantage of emergency situations, of crises, of foreign wars, to invoke the notion of national security and to clamp down on dissent and at the same time expand the power of the government, especially of the executive branch during these moments. And the Bush administration is operating within that all-American tradition, yet there's something different. And maybe I like the use of the word tactics. Maybe it's tactics. I'm not sure whether it's tactics or a mentality here. But it's much more blatant about what it's doing. And we've seen this in the government's attempt to circumvent legal due process, to evade judicial oversight in a number of its moves, especially with regard to its operations against foreigners not on American soil. There's something rather ironic here. For what is clearly the most secretive administration in American history, and secrecy is a big part of the expansion of federal power and of its repressive nature. And it's ironic that for such a secretive administration, it actually flaunts its refusal to obey traditional rules. During the McCarthy period, for example, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI engaged in what were known as black bag jobs. They broke into people's homes secretly, photographed papers, and then left. They also conducted a lot of illegal wiretaps, actually wiretapping conversations between attorneys and their clients. But they kept it secret. J. Edgar Hoover went out of his way to make sure that the American public never found out about this. Today, the Bush administration has made this public. We have the Patriot Act containing the so-called sneak and peek provisions, which legally allow for these black bag jobs to take place. The FBI can go into your home, look at your papers, and not tell you. Similarly, there's an executive order that was delivered fairly soon after 9/11 that allowed the government to wiretap conversations between lawyers and their clients. So again, there is this kind of blatant nature of the Bush administration that's new. Its willingness to proclaim itself above the law really distinguishes it from its predecessors, both, I think, in the realm of foreign policy and at home. So I'll leave it at that, and we can talk about it more later.
Okay. When Van Gosse invited me to participate on the panel, and I saw the question was an American history question, I asked him, why me? I'm a German historian. And he said, that's why. So That's a compliment. That's not as easy as it sounds, although it feels comfortable in some ways. There is a movie being shown downtown called Uncovered. Ray McGovern is a CIA agent in it. And he was there in the question and answer period after the film. And he stood up to say, these are all CIA agents who are angry and disappointed at the way their material has been manipulated and made wrong, you know. So he was in the audience, and he stood up, and he used the F word, fascism. He said, I'm really worried that we're moving toward fascism. So some of what I would have to say is, where is that a relevant comparison? There are shelves and shelves of books debating what fascism is, so that's not really as easy as it sounds. But there are echoes, there are analogies. An analogy is not a comparison. A comparison requires detailed, you know, side by side. But analogies, I think of as a recognition of pattern, an echo from the past that somehow rings a bell. And in that limited way, I think there's something to be said about it. Heraclitus said, you never step into the same stream twice. But I think you can recognize ripples, and you could know there's a waterfall downstream, you know. So there's something to be said for it. So, you know, later on I can develop a little bit about what is and what is not, you know, relevant to that comparison. I do want to say, because it's come up here, I think the three Americanists see a lot of continuities, and from what I do know of American history, that rings true to me. But, you know, there is always the question for historians about continuity and rupture, and at what point quantitative changes, small quantitative changes, erupt or evolve into a qualitative change, and in fact a paradigm shift. And I think that's the question Van wanted us to explore here. I can say that for the Nazi analogy, that there was nothing really all that sudden either, you know, which is why a lot of people didn't recognize it, you know, saw it as even more temporary than it turned out to be. Why a lot of Jews, for example, stayed, my family stayed for 5 years. I was born under Hitler. I won't tell you the year exactly, but, you know, but I was. So, you know, that whole continuity thing has to be watched for the radical moment that it might be. But the other thing I wanted to would like to speak about when we get more into a little bit more detail is something that takes me even further back as a European historian, and I will take a big leap and say feudalism. I'm thinking of corporate feudalism. I'm thinking of the way that non-state actors, such as multinational corporations, such as private military firms, are accruing power that go under the radar of states, and certainly go under the radar of the democratic rules of states that consider themselves democratic. And I think there's a real danger here that state power, that I've never been so fond of, and certainly the whole fascist analogy depends on state power and state repression, there's a whole other set of actors out there that are very dangerous, in my view, and that need to be taken into the analysis, whatever else, you know, we may think about that. So that's what I would like to develop a little bit further.
All right, well, we've got some questions to look at. I do have to say two things. I'll be very brief. To me, there's more of a break than my other American historians see, because I guess I feel that when you have this many things adding up, at a certain point, that sum does look radically different. But I may be wrong. I'm also struck, and I won't do kibitz too much, the comment that Goering is supposed to have made in, what, 32, when I hear the word culture, I reach for my revolver, well, that certainly sets off a few bells with this crowd, and with the president himself, that conscious anti, who we are, in effect. Well, here's the first question, and it gets to motive, I think, and motive is important, right? I mean, do they intend a break? In some ways, you've suggested they do. Does the foreign and military policy of the Bush administration represent a genuine war on terrorism? Is that really the policy, or is it the elaboration, the excuse for the elaboration of long-standing right-wing agendas at home and abroad? But that, of course, requires us to think about what exactly do we mean by right or right-wing in the U.S. context. Which of you?
A quick maybe a rejoinder to your, okay. your comment to try to clarify what I was saying in my in contrasting strategy and tactics. That's not a strategy doesn't mean important and tactics means unimportant. It was simply a device to try to distinguish between where it seems to me actions can be, we can see deeper roots of certain kinds of actions and where something's new. And tactically, there it is a radical break. And it seems, to, and above all, it seems to me, there's this question of preventive war. We are not a peaceful people. I mean, we have a, to put it mildly, rich military history. But there has tended to be a certain reticence or a determination to cloak things, Mexico, 1898, that this administration, in its brazen way, is kind of throwing aside. And it seems to me that that's why the Iraq War, in the run-up to the war, so many people were energized, and why, especially as we sink into this quagmire, it continues to be such a momentous event. It's tactics, but boy, it's tactics that really matters, because it's tactics if it becomes a routine part of the way we behave in the world, the promise is a pretty bleak one for our future.
Can I just follow up on that, and then we'll work around to your question? I think it is important to I would agree with everything Andy just said, except to emphasize one other aspect, and that is, if there is a certain kind of consensus on, if you call it strategy, I'll call it long-term kinds of American values that may not be necessarily always the dominant values, but they're there. One of the things we have to explain is how much support Bush gets for all the things he's done. These are radical acts, and cumulatively so many things in such a short period of time, so dramatic. That is really radical, yet he doesn't seem to have lost, he lost some of us, but there's still a lot of people who consider this leadership. And I think unless we recognize it, there are parts of American history, culture, that feel more comfortable than I do with certain aspects of this tradition. And I think this, well, if I can continue a bit, goes to your question. I mean, my own feeling is that terrorism, a new kind of danger, could indeed produce novel kinds of responses, both in the international domain and in the domestic realm. But I don't think that's what's happened here. I believe that most of the things that are most disturbing, including the tough guy image in the world, including the restriction of citizen rights and civil liberties, have been a part of a certain part, and this is what is the right, but a certain part of the right, some of the parts that Bush calls his base or whatever this is, a lot of the people who have been around him are very influential. This is why I see this as Jacobin, really, that there's a small group of people who seem to constitute the United States. And they seem to have had for a very long time both beliefs about domestic policy and foreign policy that are exceedingly radical. And it seems to me that this was an opportunistic maneuver.
I'd like to sort of play devil's advocate and just ask, what would have happened if there hadn't been 9/11? In other words, how much of this switch, you know, has been precipitated, caused by, used, because there was this moment? You know, Hitler had the Reichstag fire, and one can, I'm reading about that now, and you can see a lot of, what do we call them, patterns, parallels, ways in which a very determined government takes advantage of a crisis. And I just wonder whether this could have occurred without 9/11. And I'm just throwing it open to other people to deal with.
We heard Richard Clark say they had the plan for Iraq ready to go.
But could they have implemented it absent 9/11? Yeah. And I think the answer is no. And that in that sense, yes, I'm not exactly willing to compare 9/11 to the Reichstag fire, but in some respects these are extraordinarily sophisticated people. In other respects, they're stupid, but they're sophisticated in the sense that they viewed 9/11, I believe, not as simply a tragedy, which it certainly was, but yes, as an opportunity. Now, what was the opportunity? The opportunity, again, trying to put this in the context of continuity, which obviously is going to be the dead horse I will beat. The 20th century was the story of the rise of American power. The middle portion of that century, the theme of the middle portion, was to establish American dominance of two crucial regions of the world, Western Europe and East Asia, and to do that in the context of the Cold War with the Soviet as our adversary. Cold War ends, Soviet Union goes away, U.S. dominance of Western Europe and East Asia doesn't go away. And we still keep our troops in Okinawa and in Korea, and despite the rebasing scheme, we're still going to keep our troops in Western Europe. What happens at the end of the Cold War, in this, the way I'm telling the story, is that the moment is presents itself to reconsider U.S. strategy with regard to a third strategically crucial region, and that's the so-called Greater Middle East. During the Cold War, during the center part, and even to the latter part of the 20th century, U.S. policy there had been one of relatively low profile, collaborate with right-wing regimes that could guarantee a certain amount of order. It was really a theater, an economy of force theater. But in the 1990s, there was already a rising critique of that approach to the Middle East that said that the status quo is not good enough. In essence, we need to bring the Greater Middle East into the American empire. Yes, it's an informal empire. We need to ensure that this part of the world is liberated. And when the Bush administration came to power, it brought to power those people. And when 9/11 occurred, those people said, now's the moment to implement that. And so the answer to the question is, no, it's not a war on terror. Because really, if what you cared about was terror, you wouldn't be invading Iraq. This is a war to open up and to transform the Greater Middle East in the same sense that these people think that the United States opened up and transformed Western Europe and East Asia.
It's interesting. I happen to have lunch with a U.S.-born high-level executive of Royal Dutch Shell in September 2002. When, you know, the war, we didn't know. We thought probably it would happen. Maybe we could stop it. And I said, well, what are you people in Europe? What do people in Europe think? And he said exactly what Andrew just said. I mean, almost the words were the same, that this is what this war is about. So I'm not hearing anybody saying that it really is a war on terrorism. But I'd like to hear more, because we're talking about continuities, and I recognize, how could one not, as an American historian, recognize the continuities from the Palmer raids or from the internment, or the know-nothings, for that matter, let's say. How do we define this administration's policies?